I'm 10 years old and I'm sitting in the dugout of the baseball diamond at my middle school. It's PE and I'm trapped. Not only by a section of chain link fence that surrounds me, but also by a half circle of laughing sixth graders. And I've been here before. I'm very familiar with this. I know I'm stuck, and the only way to get out is to give them exactly what they want. For me to say Chuck E. Cheese. Just that, just the name Chuck E. Cheese. Now you may be asking yourself, Sean, buddy, just say Chuck E. Cheese. It's just a name, right? For me, when I was that young, just a name was more than just a name. Words were more than words. The act of speech was incredibly difficult for me. I had a host of speech impediments. A stutter, which means I got stuck on a word, like a playing card in the spoke of a bicycle wheel. I had a stammer, which was kind of like I couldn't force a letter out of my throat. It would get kind of stuck like a car flooding an engine. And I had what I later came to know in my adult life as phonetic disorders. A certain combination of letters creates an unnatural shape or sound. So my CHs sounded like ch. And my S's were th. My tongue just whistled past my teeth, and I couldn't really connect my mouth. It was really a physical impediment that I didn't have a name for. All I knew was the embarrassment it caused whenever I tried to speak, which was rarely. This was a private shame that I kept as a child for years. So, I'm back in the dugout, right? So now you can imagine the gales of laughter, the hilarity caused by a name like Chuck E. Cheese, which was the kiss of death for me, right? It's got two CHs and a string of S's at the end. I was doomed. But this was their most favorite pastime. And I think I kind of adopted being kind of like a class clown to them, albeit a dysfunctional one. And I think they got a lot more enjoyment out of pulling my string like I was a wind-up toy, but they were more amused by pulling the string on a broken toy and watching it sputter out, more delighted in what it couldn't do than what it could.
Chucky Keith.
Funny, right? So I said it, hoping they'd let me go. But all that meant was now they knew how easy it was to get some quick amusement, so they asked me again and again. And that's kind of what school was like for me when I was in the sixth grade. You know, I tried to get along the best I could by being nice, but that only went so far. And this was kind of like I lived within this. It was kind of like navigating a maze, you know? I learned to avoid certain situations, to not put myself out there for certain things, to kind of hold back, because that was my way to escape. And I couldn't wait to get home. Like most kids, you know, you go home and you play. For me, I created these private worlds that I lost myself in, you know, whether it was singing to myself or writing a song or my favorite pastime, making little comic books. And I would draw speech bubbles with dialogue inside of it. And I would whisper to myself in a voice that I wish I could hear out loud, you know, a voice that was unbroken and uninhibited by this painful maze of speech that I was trapped in. But the weekends were the best, because on the weekends, I got to sing. And when I was 10 years old, I was a member of the Phoenix Boys Choir. Not to, you know, pat myself on the back here as a 37-year-old man, but as a 10-year-old, I was a member of a world-renowned boy choir. And we had just an exceptional choir master, Dr. Jones. And every Saturday, we would gather in a little practice room with some squeaky black plastic chairs and a tile drop ceiling and a stand-up piano in the corner. There's like 30 boys all packed in there. I loved those Saturday mornings because I felt normal. I felt like I belonged, and these were my friends. And that time of year was really special. This was around early October when we were starting to gear up for practicing for our Christmas concerts, which would come months later, but we got to get ready now because, you know, we were singing some challenging material. Benjamin Britten was one of the composers I loved to sing, you know, these really complex cathedrals of sound, these majestic choral works, you know, and we were practicing all of that together because Christmas time was a very special time for the choir. We usually did this, there was a Christmas skit that was attached to our Christmas concerts, so we would sing these carols and cantatas, and there was a through line through it all, and it was the story of the three wise men going to see baby Jesus. And every year they would choose three boys from the choir to be the three wise men. It's a speaking role, so you can imagine Sean wasn't picked for this one. But we would practice our songs, and then we'd take a break, and then the three wise men would read their lines from their chairs. And I would just be sitting there listening and thinking to myself, I want that. That must be so cool to be a wise man, to have a role, to have something to say. I really wanted that for myself. I think more though, beyond me just being an insufferable theater kid, at that age, I really wanted to be heard. More than anything, I wanted people to understand me. So I would listen to these three wise men and thinking, you know, one day I will be wise. You know, one day I will get past this. I'll grow out of it. But Monday would come and I would find myself back in the classroom. And, you know, you're in class. Did you ever have to read aloud from the book? You all get your books out and then you go desk by desk, row by row. It's like, okay, turn to page 4 and you take turns with the paragraphs reading. Oh God, I hated that. I would be counting the desks before it was my turn. And when it would get to my desk and I would have a big paragraph in front of me, I remember this one time when my throat locked up. I couldn't get past the first word. My stammering became even worse when I felt anxious. All it would take was just a couple of giggles floating behind my back. My cheeks would get hot. And I would think how foolish of a dream that is to believe that any day I'd be wise. What a foolish thing to dream for, you know? I kind of learned to stuff that dream deeper and forget about it or pretend it wasn't there. Until one day my mom picked me up from school, as she usually did. And that day was kind of different because she was driving a bit slower. I could sense that something was on her mind. We drove past a pumpkin patch set up outside a grocery store, and some hay was thrown down in the parking lot, and I'm kind of looking out the window, and my mom stops at a stoplight, and she kind of rests her hands on the wheel, and she turns to me and says, "So, some of your teachers have asked me if you would be interested in going to see a speech therapist. Do you know what that is, Sean?" I said, "No." In the back of my mind, I'm like, is that like a doctor? Don't you go see a doctor when you're sick? I'm not sick. And then like, I was imagining like, are they going to like announce it over like the loudspeaker in the classroom? Like, "Attention, Sean, come to the doctor's office. It's time to see the speech therapist." She kind of rubbed her hands on the steering wheel and she said, "Because, you know, I want this to be something that you choose to do. That's important." You know, I'm looking at that stoplight and the car is kind of idling right there in the road. And I'm just looking at that dry hay on the floor of the parking lot. And all I can think of is the dry grass that's in the dugout. And I really thought about that, you know, choice. I think I got so used to being stuck, whether I was stuck behind a problem letter of a word I couldn't force out of my mouth or stuck behind that chain link fence in that dugout. But I don't want to go to a therapist. I remember distinctly, sharply turning to her, my left, and just saying, "No, I don't want to do that. I'm going to figure this out." And when the light turned green, we kept on driving. And Saturday comes. And with it, I have this feeling of like, now is the time to step into this new way forward. And that's when I walked right up to Dr. Jones. He was putting his music in his briefcase, getting ready to go home. I kind of say, you know, in a little voice, "Dr. Jones?" He turns around. "I want to be the understudy in the Christmas play. You ever see that in someone's face when, like, their eyes smile, but their face doesn't quite catch up? I could see his eyes kind of wrinkle behind his glasses, and he looks down at me as if to wonder, I didn't know we were doing a long day's journey into night. So Dr. Jones looks down at me, and he asks, okay, Sean, what role were you thinking of doing? And I look up to him, and I said, all of them. I want to be the understudy for all the three wise men. His eyes kind of smile, and there's like kind of a wrinkle in the corner of his face, and he says, I'll be right back. So he goes downstairs, and he photocopies the script. And when he hands it to me, I can feel the weight of it. And this thing's heavy. It's got to be at least 5 pages. And I'm flipping through it, and I'm sitting on the curb outside the building where my dad would come pick me up. And I'm flipping through the script. I'm like, oh, Sean, what have you gotten yourself into? Like, I'm looking at all these words like angel. There's that NG, angel. I can hear in my head, that's what you're going to sound like, Sean. You're going to get up on stage and you're going to be a fool. And I'm looking at angel and camels and sheep. It's gotten so much, I'm thinking, oh no, I've made a huge mistake. My dad picks me up, and he looks at me, and he's like, what do you got there? Well, this is the script. I'm going to be the understudy for all three wise men. My dad smiles, and he says, well, we better get practicing. You know, the concert's coming up. And he was right. You know, by then, it was early November. You know, I'm kind of counting down the days to our first Christmas concert, which was usually like December 1st. So I got this script, and it's at home, and whereas before I'd come home and I'd draw some cartoons or sing a song, I come home and I'm ready to practice. I want to make sure I know the lines. And so I got into this habit of, like, my dad and I, we would run lines together, and I would sit next to him in his bed like we were roommates in a Neil Simon play, and he would be my scene partner, right? And I would go through the script, and every time I would get stuck on a word where, like, that's that stutter I talked about, remember? You know, I'd get, it's that fluttering, those nerves. He would softly say, it's okay, just sound it out, just sound it out. And I would, you know, sitting next to him, I'd sound it out. And at school, I'd be standing in line for, like, lunch, you know, and I, in my mind, I'd be repeating the lines to myself. At kickball, I'd be way out in left field because the teacher was smart enough to know where to put me to be most valuable, right? So I'd be way out in left field, daydreaming and repeating these lines in my head, just getting ready. And as the air got cooler, this feeling came upon me of, like, what if you practice all these lines and you never get to go up on stage? And our first Christmas concert happens, you know, it's December 1, and I'm back in the choir, and I'm looking out, and I see the three wise men, you know, and they got other little outfits on and their fake beards made of, like, painted cotton balls. And, you know, there's a fake, like, wooden camel cut out. And they're doing their lines, and I'm kind of, like, repeating them under my breath back there in the choir. And I'm like, well, at least you're ready. You know, at least you tried. But then about a week goes by, and the air gets cooler, and one of those boys catches a cold. And it was wise man number 3. Now, wise man number 3, he didn't have the most lines in the script, right? But he had the most important one. And that was a cue line, directing the choir, now is your time to sing. And the line was, and look, up in the rafters, and thousands of angels are singing. So right there, I'm in trouble. Angel. But I'm wise man number 3. I mean, it's time for me to step up to the plate. So I'm backstage. It's the night of the show. And I'm getting dressed in this robe. And now I'm putting on the fake beard. And I'm scratching my face underneath it because it's really kind of itchy. And I'm just like, I've made a huge mistake. And now it's too late because I've grown facial hair. And now I am a wise man. And so I'm kind of like wedged backstage at the church where they keep the sacramental wine, and I can see it in the cupboard, and we're all kind of shoulder to shoulder backstage, and we start to file out. And, you know, I was so used to like following the choir and walking up on the risers behind me, but this time I got to like walk out on stage with the two other wise men. And one of them kind of smiled at me behind his beard, like, "You ready? This is going to be fun." And I'm like, well, maybe fun for you. I got some doubts. And so we're kind of shuffling out, and the lights are hot. I can't see anybody out in the audience, but I know that my parents are there. My sister's there. I know that they're there watching me. And we're shuffling through, and I'm pretending to like look off in the distance at the desert surrounding me. You know, I'm doing some pantomiming. Already at that age, I was a huge ham. And, you know, we're kind of getting through it. And like, just like I would count the desks before it was my turn to speak, I'm counting the lines before it's my turn to speak. And I got to give that cue line. All I can see is darkness, but I can hear the people breathing, and they're waiting. The choir's waiting, and I know that my line is next. And so when it comes, I close my eyes and I say the line.
"And look."
And
up in the rafters,
I can hear my voice.
"And thousands of angels are singing."
I hear it. For the first time, I hear myself. And it's echoing in the church. And I'm like, I wanted this for so many years. More than anything, I wanted this. I wanted to be heard. I don't know if any of you have felt that before, but you finally get that thing you've always wanted. I hope it happens for you, because it happened for me when I was just a kid. And I heard my voice, and the choir starts singing. And the sound of the music they made almost sounded like the sound of somebody saying, "It's gonna be okay. You're gonna be okay." It got colder that December in Phoenix, and as the temperature dropped, so too did more wise men. And wouldn't you know it, because I memorized all the lines, I ended up playing every single wise man. I was wise man number 2 one night, and then a couple days later, I'm wise man number 1 with all the lines, just hogging the stage. I mean, I was so, after that point, when I finally knew that I could do what I always believed I could, I would have played every role on the stage. I even would have played the fake wooden camel if they let me. I would have played hay. I would have played sand. I would have played baby Jesus with zero lines. I would have done anything, because it's that feeling of, I can do this. Looking back on that, at no point in between Dr. Jones handing me the script, me learning the lines, and literally putting on the fake beard, not once did Dr. Jones check up on me to see if I was doing okay or if I knew the lines. I would like to believe that he trusted me, that somehow he knew Sean's got this. And I never forgot Dr. Jones just trusting me. You know, I'm a lot older now. I still have trouble trusting myself. I don't know if you've noticed, but you know, this entire time I've been telling you the story, at every turn, I'm conscious of that maze. I still feel like I'm in that maze. I have to watch my letters. I have these trouble letters, P's and T's and S's. They trip me up sometimes. And every day is a new stage. Every time I leave my apartment, I feel like I'm getting dressed as a wise man. I'm going out there and I gotta perform. And I hope that people don't notice. And every time I feel doubt, or worry, which is a lot, I like to imagine that backstage, there is little Sean, and he's there with me. I'd like to believe that he's back there, and when he looks up at me, he says, you're not broken. You never were. But I'm sorry you still feel that way. You shouldn't have to, Sean. As a storyteller, I often wonder, like, what am I really giving, you know? It's just a story. It's just me telling my feelings, and maybe that's what it is, you know? Maybe what I can give is just the voice of somebody who's been there. And if you're there, if you're doubting yourself, if you need a little Sean backstage, you know, I'm there too. I think that's where it all started, me pointing up at the rafters and believing there were angels up there looking after me, because I really could have needed an angel back then. Maybe they were always there, you know? Maybe that's all what this voice is to you right now. It's a voice backstage saying, hey, it's okay. I'm looking out for you.